If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and today I am joined by Roger Johnson, one of the Hall of Change Great Eight inductees from this year, a gentleman who went from negative to positive and now is contributing to his society in a major, major way. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about where you're from.
Yeah, so I am from the east side of Bridgeport, where I grew up in a really small apartment with just me and my mom.
And what kind of mom was she?
First of all, she was, is, and will likely always be awesome, but that disclaimer being made. So my mom got pregnant with me when she was a teenager. And what I think, where I think my mom stands out, when she got pregnant, she stopped smoking weed, got a job at the phone company, started going to college, and just really established her life. You know what I mean? And just, so she a phenomenon of a human being. But, you know, growing up, there was the experiences of, you know, your home by yourself. Because when you have a mom who's by herself and a go-getter, she's at work during the day and college at night, and you're at home to figure it out. You know what I mean? I probably had a good deal too much freedom, and I lost some freedom because of it, but I guess we'll get there at some point.
What kind of ethics did you gain from your mother?
My mother has always put an extreme amount of emphasis on the whole work thing. You know what I mean? You don't mess, to quote her, you don't mess with people's money. In other words, I don't care how mad you are at a person, you don't go to their job and act a fool. You don't mess with people's money is the expression she would always say. And so you always have to have a job. Even when I had a bike, she would always say that bike is your bread and butter. Because if you're going to cut grass or shovel driveways, you need your bike to get around. And so my mother's foundational thing was, you're going to go to work. You know, work is an important thing. If you're going to go to college, great. You're going to work. If you're going to school, great. What's your part-time job? My mom was, her whole emphasis was work. Get out there and, you know, get a job and work.
And seeing her day-to-day, make an effort, how did that, you know, influence you early on?
And I got to tell you, so the trouble is, I think she went unseen, at least from my perspective, where if what I just told you is retrospective, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas I know she went to school. I know she had a job. Back then, I didn't really see it. I didn't really hear it. I didn't really pay attention to it. All I knew was I had these questions about myself, whether I could articulate them or not. Who am I? You know what I mean? Where do I fit in I guess, in the social stratum of my neighborhood? You know, do I belong? What girl likes me? What girls do I like? Who am I cool with? Who should I be afraid of? And you're just kind of, you're figuring it out. But the crying shame I'm saying is that what I just said about my mother is retrospective. I didn't realize it at the time. And so the lessons she would have taught, it's not that they went unspoken on her part. They certainly went unheard on my part, because I wasn't the type of kid to learn very quickly. You know what I mean? Especially not from someone telling me what reality was. I had to bump my head about 100,000 times.
Who was a positive male role model early on that you think back stands out in your life?
Who? That's a good one. A positive role model. So my grandfather was awesome. He again, I'm going to answer this question, but I just want to say the crazy thing is the things that I'm going to say, I didn't see it back then. I didn't see, okay, here you have a guy who was a veteran who came here to Connecticut from Philadelphia on a love story, started an accounting shop and did all these things. I just know grandpa has an office. You know what I mean? I never looked at him and said, I want to be a tax accountant. I never looked at him and said, I want to be I want to be an entrepreneur. I was just, I, I think I was blinded by the forest of the, I'm going to say youthful possibility, but I don't mean that in the necessary, when I, not possibility in terms of I want to be a engineer. It was more like, you know, where's the fun at? You know, what do I, where do I go and to have fun and who do I have fun with and all that comes with that. Just, I was a kid, you know what I mean? I was just a kid and I was oblivious to the realities around me that weren't kid things. So basically I was a kid in an unkid environment. I didn't know it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what kind of man was your grandfather and what kind of values now that you look upon influence you?
He was an incredibly sharp man, right? Whereas he would always emphasize, whereas my mom would emphasize making money, saving was his thing. Again, retrospectively, he would always kind of say, look, because he would have, we'd all have these quote unquote banking accounts in his office where, and they were envelopes, right? This envelope has my name on it. This envelope has my cousin's name on it. And you would go in there and say, hey, can I have a dollar? Can I have whatever? He would take it out the envelope. And he would say to you, hey, listen, if you're always taking out more than you're putting in, your envelope is going to be empty. But you know what I mean? Right, blew right past my mind. You know, stuff I wish I grasped. You know, I know we're not talking about incarceration yet, but it was when I was able to kind of slow down and be in jail and kind of talk to him on the phone that his lessons started sinking in. Like, oh, that's what I should have did. Oh, that's how I should have saw it. That's what you were saying. But it's almost like I had to sit still. And of course, the police made me sit still, but I had to sit still to process the lessons. It was like, I don't know what's wrong with me, man. It's like my brain is a brick. It always, people thought I was smart. People in the family always say I was intelligent, but I didn't even process that. I didn't see the, I can't think of a single lesson that I grasped as a kid. It just never made it through this thick skull of mine, you know. But serious values, you know what I mean? Just that I can't say I come from a deeply religious family. But like I said, it was the work ethic, it was the saving, it was the maintaining your property. That was their thing. And it got lost on me for a very long time. Very long time.
Wow. So now you're out there as a youth. What was the allure that called your attention?
So where I live, it wasn't a bad neighborhood, right? But up the street, it's almost like, I don't know if you're familiar with Bridgeport, but you cross Boston Avenue and you walk a few blocks up, I'm on a crack block. And to me, it wasn't crack block, because obviously I wasn't selling drugs at the time. That's where the cool kids were. You know what I mean? That's where the pretty girls were. And so I'm going to go up the street, and when there's a violent fight, and when I say violent, I mean violent, and there's a violent fight, I'm more following the crowd and laughing and enjoying the show. Whereas thinking back as a dad, because you know my son is 13, no, leave. You know what I mean? Go home. Find someplace else to hang out. You know what I mean? But you see, but now you're in that environment, you're seeing that your friends who aren't selling drugs are aspiring to sell drugs. And the reason why was obvious. The guys who were selling drugs had the dopest clothes. They had the nicest cars. The girls wanted them. And that seemed like the thing to do. You know what I mean? Because that it's not just because of what they had. It was what my friends at the time were aspiring to do. And I remember sitting on the block, and it's funny, an undercover came in, and we were like 12. And the drug dealers didn't know he was an undercover. I didn't know he was an undercover. My friend did. My friend was sitting there trying to get the drug dealers, because I think we were like 12 or something at the time, to let him in. And a guy came in and he had a deal, whatever the deal was. And he asked them to make us leave. And when we were walking out, my friend, you know, that was an undercover, because why would he want us to leave? Why would he care that we left? You know what I mean? And so, and he was right. And I sat there and watched the block get raided either that day or the next day. But we still had the stupidity to want to be around it because it was fun. It was exciting. It's what everybody was doing. And so I think on someplace in the back of my mind, it set my hopes and expectations. Like this is the thing to do. And that's kind of that. I can't speak to how much that would shape a person. It's almost like if you grew up in a basketball family around basketball courts, the most skillful players are who you want to be, right? Same thing for football, baseball, whatever it is. There wasn't a basketball court. There wasn't a football field. It was people laughing, having fun. Some of them were smoking weed or whatever smoking, going upstairs with girls, having the time of their life. And that said, I was like, this is the life I want. And that really, really, not drugs or not. I mean, drugs, selling drugs or not. The fun of it, it set my aspirations at that time.
Mm. You seem to hold yourself accountable.
Oh, sure. Like someone told my mom, because when I went to jail, my mom blamed herself a lot. Someone once said to her, God was the perfect parent, but Adam and Eve still messed up. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, the choices I made were the choices I made. The mistakes I made were my mistakes. I mean, we'd be a fool to say that environment doesn't play a part in incarceration in these factors. But at the end of the day, there's people who came from my environment who went to college and never got arrested. So my mistakes were mine. My choices were mine. I didn't have to be a follower. You know what I mean? It would have helped if I were to have latched on to better role models. Whereas if I were forced to go to, let's say, boys clubs or a YMCA where there were, as you referenced, positive male role figures to role models to look at. But, you know, outside of that, those are all just kind of contributing factors. At the end of the day, I made mistakes, you know?
You're listening to The Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Canelario here with Roger Johnson, Hall of Change, Grade 8 inductee this year, going over his history and some of the ideology, right, and the thought process that takes place when you're a young person. You're now out there. You made your mistake. You end up incarcerated. There's always a moment where something switches, the light switch hits. What was that moment for you?
All right. So two things. The foundational thing, obviously, is religious in nature. I accepted Christ as Lord. But I think that I want to really kind of put that in appropriate context. Right. So when you go to jail and you're young, I'm from Bridgeport. I'm black. I'm 18. The gangs recruit you. You know what I mean? That happens fairly quickly. I didn't know at the time, but a religious conversion of some sort, Islam, Christianity, whatever it is, are one of the few things that the gangs respect when it comes to, okay, we're not going to force you in because you got involved with this religion. Wasn't why I did it, but it just, you know, I didn't even know at the time. And the second, what we might call OGs, all knew my father. They knew my uncle because I come from, many of my uncles went to jail. My father went to jail at 18 for the same thing I went to jail at 18 for. And I say, so the OGs knew my dad. And so because I was a little more laid back because of my religious conversion and because these guys knew my father and my uncles, I was kind of with the OGs a lot. And what I noticed, though, addiction had certainly touched their lives. They all had, these guys were serial entrepreneurs. I remember there was a guy there who was day trading commodities and all that stuff. And it started opening my mind to possibilities outside that I had never even thought about or in some cases even heard of. And so where I remember back then, guys would always rush to the newspaper to get the police blotter because it was the gossip of who got arrested this week. I started looking at the classifieds like, oh, what business is for sale? What is this? What is this? And my dream engine, as I'm going to call it, started really waking up when I started becoming aware of just the possibilities that a person, you know, the things that a person could achieve for in terms of entrepreneurship based on being around people who had now done it. It just so happened that addiction had touched their lives and they're in jail. But it was that really set it adjusted the scope of my personal expectations. You know what I mean? The morality piece was like more likely religious, but as far as the sense of potential, and I will say it's the sense of potential that's driven me to a very large extent, that came from being around people who had operated successful and, you know, and operated series of businesses.
Having a good example of success or the ability to succeed, how important is that in your life?
I got to tell you, in my opinion, people don't do what they don't think they can do, right? And if I've never seen someone who looks like me, who speaks like me, who dresses like me do something, I don't think I have a whole lot of reason to expect that I can do it, right? And so, to me, it goes back to what I was saying, I think a moment ago or a while ago, whereas if everyone who spoke like me, dressed like me, talked like me, wanted to sell drugs, and that was the most successful thing I saw, it set my aspirations. then if you go on and you meet people, you find out there's these possibilities. And I think very, very often it's realizing that something is possible that makes it a choice. You know what I mean? And that, to me, very often, that's the biggest thing. If I believe I can do it, now I can choose to do it. And in choosing to do that, I'm inadvertently choosing not to do a bunch of other things, like criminality, like necessarily drug use, because it's going to hinder the choice I've made to pursue this thing I now believe to be possible.
You mentioned drug use and stuff. That's a big hurdle in many people's lives.
Sure.
How did you handle that part of your life so valiantly?
So now I will say my dad had struggled with addiction very much so. And so my thing was weed. I smoked a bunch of weed, but by the grace of God, I never went far beyond weed. Should I say marijuana? This is electric drum. I don't know what word to say, but that's what that. So it, in my case, I can't say addiction to a substance really contributed to my life that much, not my personal addiction to it. To me, it was like the more so the whether I knew it or not, the addiction to seek acceptance from someone. You know what I mean? Mm. Dad wasn't there. So if this group of people like give me a sense of acceptance and a sense of belonging, there has to be some level. I'm not speaking technically when I say some sort of dopamine reward or some psychological reward, that it's a high associated with feeling like you belong, feeling like you found your group. You know what I mean? And I will say that feeling of being addicted to feeling like you finding a group you belong to, regardless to the group, regardless to what they're doing, that's a high. You know what I mean? And if it's the wrong group, if it's the wrong activity, that will certainly shape some stuff in it. And I will say, I became addicted. And I say this in shame. I became addicted to becoming a follower very early on. And I had to detox from being a follower. And that process was big. You know what I mean? The result of that, stop following the crowd. It helped that all my hair fell out and I stopped being cool when I lost my eyebrows. But so my list of people, the list of groups I belong to kind of, you know, might have slipped. But all seriously, being serious though, just getting over the idea of having to be accepted by a group, having to be accepted by every person and needing that affirmation, that was monumental, because now I can make choices without having to worry about who agrees with the choice. So again, now I can make choices based on what I deem is possible and not based on what the crowd thinks is okay and what the crowd thinks is achievable.
Wow. Yeah. You mentioned now your father.
Yeah, yeah.
How was that relationship? Was it something that you needed to mend and grow into?
Fatherhood?
You know, between you and your father.
Oh, my father.
Yes, between you and your father, because that is something that.
Got you. I got you.
Affects a lot of individuals and a lot of youth.
So I'll say this, and Dad, if you're hearing this, I love you, man, wherever you at. But so as I said, my father currently will struggle with addiction. Right. I didn't realize at the time that as a kid and as a young adult, how much of a monster addiction can be. And so in judging his absence, because my whole life he was either in prison, on his way to prison, on his way back from prison. And often when I'm volunteering in the prison now, I tell that story how he would come home from prison, bring me to play basketball and get a slice of pizza. And I'll see you next week. And I wouldn't see him again for years. You know what I mean? And it was this cycle of it. And so he's always been a fun dude, right? And so he's never lost the sense of fondness for me, but he lost the ability to be counted on, to be relied on. And so I remember the last, I'll say, pizza promise I had, I bumped into him at, I was in high school and I was hanging out with friends, and I just bumped into him by accident and we hung out. We were playing Duck Hunt. You got to Nintendo. We were playing Duck Hunt. We had a really good time. And then when we left, when we were all leaving, he's, I'll see you next weekend. I was like, I said something crazy. It was like, I'll see you in 3 years. Then we're, you know, something like that. And I wasn't intending to be disrespectful, but in me saying it, it's clear that a certain level of respect had dissipated, only because let's be honest, Pop, we know you're not going to show up. You know what I mean? And I remember because my son is 13 and my son loves my pops to death, and so they like hanging out. But my son, I would see my father do the same things. Judah, I'll see you in a week and not show up. And eventually I had to say to him, listen, just stop telling him you're going to show up. Show up if you're going to, but stop promising it. Because you have credibility to rebuild. You're going to have to build a wall of credibility brick by brick by showing up. And so I will say, though, what he said to me a couple years ago, he said, if I had a father like you, like myself, I would not have turned out to be the man I am right now. I needed a father like the father you are. And I might have cried when he said it. You know what I mean? But it was, it allowed me to be understanding. Okay, you were domestically violent against my mother. Your father was, I'm not making excuses for the man. But whereas my father hit my mother, his father chased his mother out the house with a gun. He actually fired shots at my grandmother. And so I'm not making excuses for domestic violence, but I was able to understand him in the context of his life. Now, granted, I'm not gonna tell my son he's coming in a week. You know what I mean? He don't have to show up. So, but I was able to accept him in the context of his story. You know what I mean? You know, I can love you from the distance, whatever distance you are, without having to rely on you. Because one, I'm not the 12-year-old anymore. There may be a 12-year-old in me who's crying inside I'm telling you the truth as I'm saying these things to you. But in the same way I can speak to my 13-year-old son about the realities of life, sometimes I have to speak to the 12 and 13-year-old inside of myself to say, yeah, it hurt, but you understand him in his context. It wasn't that he didn't love you. It wasn't that you weren't worthy of his presence. It's that addiction is a monster. It's that his father was never a good father. And so I was able to forgive him. The problem with that statement will simply be that I felt like that there's something to forgive. I never felt like he owed me a beef. You know what I mean? Like I said, and my mother will tell me in a minute, she never went after him for child support. She's never went after him for anything. And so, there's things about their relationship that I know about from my mom, but she's never really beat him down like that verbally and said, you know, your father wasn't this and your father wasn't that. She just, you know, I'm not a fool. I mean, I know he's not here. You know what I mean? I know my mother's paying the bills by herself. I know my mother's buying the groceries by herself. And as a kid, like I said, it is what it is. But in retrospect, as you become a young adult and now a not as young adult and a father yourself, you realize where a ball was dropped. And I think, if anything, it's contributed to me as a father, whereas my level of activity with my kids, which I'm not ashamed of anyway, where people will think it's overboard, over the top, and more than people. Maybe I don't want to be the other Roger. His name is Roger too. Maybe I want to be more present, and maybe the slingshot goes too far. Whereas, you know, I'm hanging out playing soccer with my kids instead of letting them play with other kids on the soccer team, and maybe that took an adjustment. But on some level, I don't want my daughters, definitely, but my son to experience an absent father. I've never been a daughter, right? But I know what it's like to be a son with an absent father. I know what it's like to look for a father to show up and not show up. And so one thing I try to go out of my way for is if I say I'm going to pay for something, maybe I have to say you got to wait a week to pay there, whatever it is. But if I say I'm going to show up, I'm going to try my best to show up, because I don't want you to see what I saw. I don't want you to feel how I felt. And that's really contributed to who I am as a dad.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. We're listening to the kind and wise words of a gentleman named Roger Johnson, Grade 8 Hall of Change inductee. Now you're a contributing member to society. In which ways do you really enjoy giving back the most?
By the way, you're really good at this, dude. But so where I enjoy giving the most. Okay, so a former employee and friend of mine once was mad at me because I didn't show up at an event. And what she said to me was, she was quite upset, and she said, listen, if a city can benefit from your story, then you owe your story, right? And so now, for instance, when my son's principal asked me if I would mentor some kids at the school, my answer was, I wouldn't feel comfortable saying no, right? There's a program out in Bridgeport, Homebridge. They asked me if I would do a group for guys who are coming home from jail. My answer is, I wouldn't feel comfortable saying no to that. You know what I mean? Whereas if you can learn, not just when I say my mistakes, not just in terms of crime, but if you could learn from my mistakes and the mistakes I made in reentry, the things I would do differently from reentry, the things I would do differently in terms of building a business when you're coming home from jail. If you could learn from my mistakes and not necessarily always getting it right in my marriage or, you know, pissing my wife off when I shouldn't, you know, all these things, then I feel like I owe you. I feel like I owe you the story. You know what I mean? And so where to answer your question, I really, really, really enjoy working with people who are going through things that I've been through and sharing my insights for free. You know what I mean? I do well for myself and my business, but as far as setting that aside, just sitting down with people and working, you know, hey, I know what you're going through, and not just say, hey, I know what you're going through, brother, but look, this is what I did. I'm not telling you what to do, but this is what I did, and this is what I would do differently, and this is how I got through it. That's the stuff I love. You know what I mean? That's the stuff I love to do.
You go and you speak at jails?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm active in Whaley Avenue here in New Haven. I am active in York CI. We do that once a month. Before COVID, we were in Big Cheshire and MY, and I think they're going to be letting us back in soon. This is a shameless plug. Let us back in. And because it's what we love to do. And of course, this is not business stuff. This is not money stuff. This is us glad to give our time, because, you know, these are people in the position we've been in, and we want to see them being a better position even than we are now. And so that really is the work we do. And so where I'm trying my best to start lending more time to younger people in addition to the folks in prison, only because if you're from Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford, any inner city, right? I know society may look at it like, okay, you have the what do they call it, returning citizens or second chance, whatever they call it these days. You have that population segment in this pot. You have at-risk youth in this pot, but it's the same folks. You know what I mean? In the same way, they have the same life factors. They have very, in my opinion, the very similar factors in risks of incarceration and criminality. And so if I could talk to you before you get incarcerated, great. If I could talk to you while you're incarcerated, great. If I could talk to you upon release, phenomenal, great. You know what I mean? But to me, it's the same group of people. I just want to, I enjoy and would love to continue working with people who are struggling through stuff I've struggled through.
You talk a lot about breaking cycles, cyclical things, especially, you know, in your personal life with your father. How do you break that cycle when you're coming back and you are a returning citizen and you're re-entering society? What are some of the key factors mentally that you can give out right now?
Yes, sir. I'll say this, and I'm glad you asked that question. This is my opinion. Take whoever's listening, take it, you know, or leave it. I think the biggest factor in successfully re-entering society is knowing what you're capable of, and then taking responsibility for your own success. Now, that being said, every program and resource that could be made available to you has its place. But if I don't believe I'm capable of something, it wouldn't matter how many free trainings, how many gift cards, how many whatever you can give me, because you haven't shaped my sense of potential, right? But here's the flip side. If I know, or better yet, if I believe wholeheartedly, then I can do a thing, whatever this thing is, open a school, own a car dealership, whatever it is. If I believe I can do it, right? And I've taken responsibility to say it's going to happen if I make it happen, and it's not going to happen if I don't, then all those other programs, all those other free resources, those are just helps, right? I'm going to achieve that now, whether I get a help or not, whether it's a program or not. But like I said, that I have to believe I can do it, and I have to take responsibility for my own success, right? I have to accept the fact that it's only going to happen if I make it happen, and if I don't, it's just not going to happen. That, to me, in my personal opinion, I believe that is the most important factor in staying out of prison. I got to know I can stay out of jail. That's great. I have to know I can do my dream. I have to know I can do my vision. I have to know that I have a future that's better, that's bigger than my past, and I can do it if I do it. And to me, that's the thing. That is the most important thing of keeping a person out of jail. If I come out of jail and in my head, my biggest goal is a job. Great. Let me clear. I come out of jail and my biggest goal is the job society feeds me that I qualify for. You know, you come out of jail and there's certain, I won't name them, but there's certain jobs that people are, right, if you're coming out of jail, you can do this, 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 or this. That's great. But if I come out of jail and I believe that's my limit, it becomes very difficult to go through the trials of life associated with reentry, the traumas of life associated with processing the traumas of prison and all these things, and you're going through the requirements of the places you report and things you have to do, that becomes very difficult to process, to go through, to get through. If I don't believe I have bigger, if I don't believe I have something better, then you're asking a lot of me now. You know what I mean? You're asking a lot of a human at that point. And so I think the key is I have to know I'm prepared. I have to know I have the ability for better. And that's my thought on that.
Oh, wow. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario. We're hearing the wise words of Roger Johnson, a great eight Hall of Change inductee for this year, 2024. Tell me a little bit about this honor and what has it meant to you.
Oh, my God. So I want to say this, too, because as I'm sure we all know, when we talk about the Hall of Change, the grade eight, that's an extension of what they call hang time and her time. Right. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately because most of the things I can tell you about prison are bad. Right. Most of them, even the psychological tools a human puts on to survive prison. But one of the things I've been thinking about in terms of hang time and the prison experience, when you're in prison, you latch onto a group of people and, you know, whoever they are, your friend group, whatever, wherever you're going to call them. You eat with them, you sleep with them, you spend time with them, every bit of good news that, you know, you're sharing with them. And then you come home, right? You come home from prison and you're pursuing whatever positive thing you put on your reentry plan. That atmosphere of positive association doesn't happen anymore. And to some level, there's a hole there where you're looking for a group of people that I'm going to eat with, that I'm going to hang out with, that I'm going to spend my time with. And to me, when I think about hang time, I was just thinking about this the other day, they're almost filling a hole that people don't know exists. Whereas, okay, the one and maybe only a good thing about my prison experience, they're allowing me to latch back on with a group of people who believe in me and want me to win, and they're not looking to take advantage of me, right? And now so that is so big because it gives you the sense of belonging I referenced earlier. But I'm belonging to something positive and not something negative, something that's going to push me up and not pull me down. And then as an extension of your hang time and your hurt time, you have this Hall of Change. Now imagine what it's like to have certain COs tell you you're coming back to jail, to have certain POs tell you, yeah, you'll be back, right? And you're going into museum for not just not coming back, but for the difference you made in society upon release. And you know what I mean? And it's funded by the state of Connecticut. You get what I mean? It says to you that you were right. When I say you were right, you were right for believing you could be better. You were right for believing you could achieve better. Guess what? It's not just you anymore. Because very often when you're trying to achieve something big or something innovative, you might be your only cheerleader. You might be the only one who believes. But then when you feel like just when you get to the point and you say, you know what? I may have achieved something. Here you have hang time, Hall of Change, and saying, guess what? We agree. You did achieve something. And so, I mean, you keep going. It's not a finish line where you say, all right, I'm in the museum, time to stop the work. It's not that at all. If anything, it's say, hey, look, now society is aware of what you're capable of. Whereas you achieved what you achieved when most people didn't believe you could achieve anything. Now that we know what you can achieve, now, listen, if you were running on foot, now it's time to get on horseback. If you were on horseback, now it's time to get in a race car. And I think the Hall of Change is rocket fuel. In that way, where it says to those people who have achieved, listen, it's time to achieve more. It's time to encourage the people who you've had shared experiences with. Hey, you could be next. I was in Whaley Avenue last night, and guess what I was talking about? You guys could be next. You guys are the next leaders. In fact, not just can you be, there's a next generation who is relying on you guys to become the next generation of leaders. And that to me, that's what Hall of Change means to me.
Wow. We're in our final minutes here of our interview. The floor is yours. Anything that you would like to say to the public? Ladies and gentlemen, Roger Johnson.
Listen, I just want to say I really appreciate the recognition of, you know, the Hall of Change. I don't know if I can say this. I'm going to say it. There are very few. I'm not easily impressed, but the things that those folks are accomplishing, Charlie, Grady, Michelle Litt, the mentoring programs, like we just talked, who can get the government to open a museum for guys coming out of jail? So I really, you know, I really just want to encourage people. If you don't know about Hall of Change and Hang Time, check them out. And I can't really tell you what Hall of Change, I mean, I'm sorry, what Hang Time and Her Time are. You have to show up and see what it's like. That's, I'm honest truth. You have to show up to know what it is. And that's what I would say to our community.
Very good. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I am Jose Candelario, and we just had the most delightful conversation with Mr. Roger Johnson, Great 8 Hall of Change inductee for 2024. So until next time, thank you for your listen.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.